Welcome to This Week in Craft Beer, the podcast, a weekly show where we interview the people making the magic happen in the UK craft beer scene, sponsored by Beer Nuts, premium crunchy coated peanuts for beer. Very pleased to be here this evening with Tom Palmer, one of the founders of Mondo Brewing in Battersea, Southwest London. Tom, it's a real pleasure to have you here. Perhaps you give us a brief introduction from your perspective and just give us a little bit of your background.
Sure thing, yeah. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is, as you said, Tom Palmer. I'm one of the two co-founders of Mondo Brewing Company. My business partner also being American, Todd Madison. The two of us met while brewing in East London and started the business in late 2014. Got the beers first out to the market in spring of 2015. I was a professional brewer only for 2 years before starting the brewery. I did an apprenticeship in Japan while working another full-time job. Was a home brewer for years before that. Started home brewing in 1999 in the States. And then when I moved to Japan, I carried on home brewing, even though it was illegal there. And just to sort of recreate some of the beers that I'd been enjoying on the west coast of the United States, I moved to Japan. I moved to Tokyo from San Francisco, and the craft beer scene in the early 2000s was very lively there.
Yes.
I couldn't find a lot of the beers that I had come to enjoy, so I started just brewing exact recipes of a Sierra Nevada Pale Ale or trying to brew Pliny the Elder or various West Coast IPAs. And I was a big fan of stouts at the time. Actually, a lot of English stouts, certainly Young's Double Chocolate Stout in its strange form that it made it to the United States. I quite enjoyed it. Haven't had one in years, but that was one of the first beers where I noticed, a particular amount of depth.
Okay.
And flavor that I really liked.
Very good. And so, as you say, yourself and Todd got started at Mondo, I think, late 2014. And
that's right. We'd been writing the business plan for 6-8 months before that. And he quit the brewery we were working at in April or so of 2014. I quit in September, and we concentrated on finding a location and getting the money together and took over the building and started works on the building in December of 2014.
Mm-hmm. And you're located almost in the shadow of Battersea Power Station, not quite, but close enough that it's on the skyline as a sort of a dominant feature, not far from the river, just an interesting, very central location, but relatively a residential district, I would say.
That's true. There's a large housing estate just across from the brewery. Our side of the street is light industrial and has been that way for, the better part of the 20th century. And as you said, we're just a hop, skip and a jump from the power station, which we can see out the front window.
Yeah, I've been into the tap room a couple of times, actually, late last year, early this year, and certainly always enjoyed the environment there. I think you were certainly probably been open for a number of years prior to that. When did you actually open the tap room? That would have been fairly shortly after you established the brewery, or?
It was late July of 2015. We got the brewery done late spring, probably end of March. We put our first beers in tank and then slowly began using a lot of the wood that the So they packed the larger tanks in large crates, and a lot of the equipment that we got was, boxed up in proper wood crates and pallets. Mm-hmm. We took all those apart and used that wood, repurposed it for the tap room.
That's nice. Excellent. And it's a really nice environment there. And that would have made you one of the first dedicated brewery tap rooms in London, I would have thought.
Yes. As I mentioned already, we're both American and we come from this sort of culture of the tap room being the place where you're going to find the beer at its best, the place where you're going to get an idea of what the company is all about. You're going to see what kind of people work there. You'll see people working. It's my first experiences in small breweries in the early 1990s were of, sitting in a tap room and looking through glass and watching brewers unplugging hoses and running CIP and just doing the various jobs, and it's very intriguing. One of the reasons I became so interested in brewing was because of you could see how hands-on it was.
Yes, absolutely.
So we wanted to recreate that environment.
So talking about getting hands-on, I've just opened my can of colouring in. I don't know whether you've got one of those to hand, but I'd be very interested to taste this with you.
I do. I'm just opened the same. Yeah, so this is a 6.2% house IPA. We use crisp malt, so we have a good relationship with the malting company up in Norwich. We get our base malts and our wheat and oats from them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much across the board for anything that isn't a German or a Belgian style.
Okay.
And this one in particular has a good deal of pit malt in it, some wheat, quite a bit of oats, flaked oats. And then one of my favorite malts of all time is Carapils. I use Weyermann Carapils.
Right.
And just a sprinkle goes a long way. So our house IPA series has kind of developed into a beer that doesn't have a whole lot of bittering character, if any at all. Oftentimes what I've been doing is reducing the hopping schedule down to a cool pool addition and then a large dry hop dose. And when I say cool pool, it's we drop the temperature after the boil on the way to the whirlpool to about 85 degrees Celsius. And we're able to not really extract any of the volatile characteristics of the hops and just get a little bit of sort of bitterness conversion, but
right.
mostly retain all of that fruity character.
Mm.
And so I don't know if anybody else calls it a cool pool. It just sounded like a proper term for me. So the whirlpool
right.
is just slightly lower temperature than you would have, because after boiling, you know, you're going into the whirlpool around 99, 98, whatever.
Yep.
And you will get a lot of conversion on those hops. You'll get the utilization up to, you know, 19 or 20%. And I think when we haven't been able to measure it. We don't have the instrumentation for that. But we just through sensory analysis, we've noticed that it's a lot less aggressive with the bitterness and a lot softer. And as we adjust the water profile for the house IPA to a little bit stronger chloride dose, we get a more pillowy, soft mouthfeel.
Okay.
Which is, I hope, what you're tasting right now.
It's a beautiful beer. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an ongoing progression of the house IPA series that started about two and a half years ago.
And how many per year, the sort of variants are you brewing?
Lately, it's one to two a month.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It started off as one or two a quarter.
Right.
And as I don't know if you agree with this or notice this, but I felt a paradigm shift in the industry around 2015, 2016, 2017, mm-hmm. where everybody just went from producing really like a core range that was fixed, that had, you know, mm-hmm. you ticked off the boxes. You had a pale ale, an IPA, a dark beer, a lager.
Yep.
And there was this movement away from that and toward just constant experimentation. And for me as a home brewer, that I couldn't have been happier to move in that direction myself. as a business owner, we just had to learn how to recognize it, you know,
yes.
and make the move with our fellow brewers, guys and gals. And it's been a wonderful change to really just get more creative and experimental as we go. And the consumer's reaction to it has been complimentary the whole way.
It's a challenge, isn't it, from a business perspective? I mean, as you say, purely from an experimental brewer's perspective, perfect scenario. You can constantly be tweaking and coming up with new recipes and new ideas. But, you know, from a business perspective where you're trying to brew beers that, you know, are going to make you some money, it can be more challenging. I think you've probably got quite a nice balance at Mondo where you pre-lockdown, and hopefully once we get past this, you'll again have some sort of larger volume customers that you can rely on, where you're supplying same beer or sort of similar variants of the same beer to the restaurant trade and so forth. But, you know, I guess from the tap room, it's great that you can keep experimenting and producing the next new thing.
Certainly, yeah. We do have a core range. We do have some beers that sell well here in London. Rhodes Soda is a entry level New England pale ale.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Hopper is our house IPA, all caps. It's a classic American Pilsner.
Yep.
Machina is our sort of Helles lager. And as far as a business perspective, you're absolutely right. It is, you know, if you look at the raw material suppliers, the hop suppliers, the grain suppliers, they want to know on a fixed basis what it is that you want from them, because then they have to go out and source those amounts, you know, times seasons or years in advance with the growers. Whereas when you are constantly experimenting with stuff, you're not really giving them an idea of what they should be planting for the next year, concentrating on for their business. So it does throw things into a state of flux from that perspective. So it is good that we also have a core range that sells well, and we're able to give our suppliers that kind of upfront information to secure specific raw materials from them. And then the experimentation side is just a sort of, you know, a benefit that we get from having these good relationships. But it's not what they want to hear. They don't want to hear you order 20 kilos of the most popular hop. They want to hear you order several tons for the following, you know, 3 years in advance.
Yes. But striking that balance is all part of running the business, I guess, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
So I'd like to take you back actually to many years ago back in St. Louis. I've been reading a few interviews for this, and I came across one that referred to the fact that your dad worked at Budweiser, and you used to get to go along there when let's say your school had enough of you for that day, to put it politely. And just share that experience a little bit with me, because, you know, whilst they're, you know, they're obviously sort of the evil empire, at the same time, I'm sure that was a fascinating experience for a young lad, and you know, one that you've probably drawn on significantly over your years.
They do sort of represent this sort of good and evil within the industry. The evil part is well documented, them forcing out smaller players from shelf space, and blocking people from getting certain raw materials in the market, and buying up fonts or taps in bars, you know, spending a lot of cash to make sure that the bars have the latest equipment, but only choose their beer. That's all pretty well documented. What most people don't know is that they also did put a lot of money into R&D, which eventually benefited smaller players like ourselves.
Okay.
As you said, my father brewed there. He pretty much did every job on the way up the ladder. He got out of the army in 1971 and immediately started working there because his father worked there. And then my uncle followed suit, my father's younger brother. And so they all retired from Budweiser. And I have fond memories of going down there and you know, real people work there, you know, people just trying to make a paycheck eat a sandwich. So I do have a lot of fun experiences, and I have fun experiences of actually drinking fresh Budweiser from the taps, the undiluted Budweiser, it's an excellent beer. It's a shame that they dilute it and water it down. It's a lot stronger in the fermentation tanks.
What would be the ABV before it's diluted?
If I recall correctly, at the time it was around 6-something%.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty common practice in the industry, is to cut with water, and then you increase your yield in the end.
Yeah.
So you brew a slightly higher gravity. Mm-hmm. The impact that business had on my hometown is you can't imagine it. They owned the baseball team and the football team when I was growing up, and we got free tickets to the amusement parks in Florida as a kid. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was just sort of this all-encompassing thing. And so we never really second-guessed who they were, what they did, until I became, you know, around 18 or 19, I began to notice other brands like Guinness, Heineken, Amstel. Those were the kind of things that we could find in hometown, because, as you can imagine, a company like Budweiser, they own a lot of shelf space. So even just getting access at the local supermarket to see what other kind of beers are out there, it's just very limited. So yeah, there's certainly a love-hate thing going on there. I didn't learn all that much, you know, being suspended from school and spending the day with my dad at work. I was pretty much just told to sit in the corner and do my schoolwork. And I fairly, you know, clearly remember my father doing almost like a Homer Simpson type of role and sitting in this control room and pressing buttons to make sure that, you know, one tank emptied and another one filled. And the smells are very clear. Budweiser yeast just permeates the air all around St. Louis as you drive up this Highway 55 from my parents' house toward the center of the city. You can just smell it. Just comes on really strong.
I live just south of Reading, just west of London, and up until I think 10 or 12 years ago, there was a Carling Brewery just next to the motorway junction, and so sort of the south side of Reading had that same smell, and I kind of miss it actually. I don't miss the fact that Carling isn't brewed there anymore, but I miss the smell.
Right. Yeah. It, you know, it evokes certain memories and emotions. Yeah, mm-hmm. For sure. And I said to myself growing up that I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't go and become a brewer. I didn't have much inclination toward it. I had a couple of different careers before becoming a brewer. This kind of just fell in my lap because I couldn't find the beers I wanted when I moved to Japan. I'd already been somewhat of a home brewer in the States. And then recreating those recipes in Tokyo, I began to really brew in earnest because I wanted to get them right and taste the beers that I missed.
You mentioned there's a homebrew community in Tokyo. Now, how big of a community was that? Sort of relatively underground, and it you know, was that 10 of you, 100 of you, and how many people were involved in that sort of circle?
In 2007, 2008, I was sitting at my desk at the school that I worked at, and I was looking for ingredients and equipment, and I stumbled upon this website for a brand called Geisha Beer, and it wasn't actually a brewery. It was just some guy, this American, who had been home brewing and was kind of putting that up there as a way to connect to other home brewers. Okay. And I reached out to him and I said, you know, who are you? What is this? And he got back to me right away, and then it was all very strange. I was invited for drinks, and I ended up meeting about 11 people at a craft beer bar in Nakameguro, and I was essentially being vetted to join this
interview
group.
to check you weren't part of the sort of secret service or whatever. And
exactly. And I guess I passed because then I got invited to a Halloween party, and it was all home brewers. There were about 22. Maybe 25 maximum at one point, people that were part of this forum. Mm-hmm. So it was a secret forum that you had to have a password and an invite to. And they traded recipes and places to get ingredients and how to convert your kitchen boiling pot into a kettle that you could use, and just everything needed. And it was people from all around the world. Let's say English, Canadian, Americans, New Zealanders, South Africans, Australians, and the occasional native Japanese. And I went to this party, and they were passing around their homebrew only. That was the only beer available there. And I was just blown away. A lot of these people, you know, they worked in Japan as engineers or university professors or software tech or whatever it was that they were doing. They were completely dialed into the science of brewing, and these were some of the best beers that I'd ever had.
Wow.
And immediately I was forced to reconsider, you know, is this the path I want to go down? Can I actually, because I'm very competitive.
Right.
So I asked myself, could I compete with these people? You know, I've got to actually bring them beer at some point. They're going to want to see that I actually brew. And that's going to be a big commitment because I brew bad beer at this point compared to what they were giving me. And you know what? They were just so helpful. Every person on there to this day is still a friend of mine. Many of them have come over and visited my brewery. Some of them have also become professional brewers. There's a Devil Craft Brewing Company in Tokyo, which operates 4 restaurants and a small brewery.
Okay.
That's run by 3 of the members of the forum. Shiokaze is another brewery that just opened up. That's run by one of our members that had been He had gone on to brew at Baird Brewing Company in Numazu, Japan, and then now he started his own thing. And there, you know, some of the other expats had returned to their countries and started stuff back in the States or Australia. And they were just open about all the information. And that was sort of the way that I was introduced to brewing, was that you just share everything. So there's no more secrets. There's no more guilds or, you know, we're not going to tell you what yeast we use, or we're not going to tell you how to do this or that hops. And so my sort of introduction and indoctrination into brewing was that it's an open process, and you right. open source all of your learning, and you open source all of your recipes and your process.
And that mentality still very much prevails, doesn't it? You know, not just in Japan, but in the UK and in the US. This is the thing that really strikes me about this industry, is how cooperative and how much people look out for each other. You know, obviously there's going to be an element of competition at times, but I think the overarching driver is that open source kind of mentality.
Certainly. Over the years, I the way that I taught myself was not only to get, you know, university textbooks and read, you know, all the trade journals and every beginning brewing guide, all of that. I also just reached out to breweries at the time, you know, between 2007 and 2013. I went every vacation sort of revolved around visiting a brewery. And I became the annoying person on the tour, or, you know, the annoying guy who just kept emailing yep. Ted Brewer asking questions. And I just got that. I got that feeling from the professional side as well. It seemed like by that point, a lot of these brewers had come up through the ranks of home brewing and started a brewery or got a job in a brewery, washing kegs or scrubbing the floor or whatever it was. And so they had sort of, there was this camaraderie immediately. There was the ability to just walk in, say that I was a home brewer, not be arrogant or, you know, assuming about any of it, and just get a lot of respect and answers to every question I had.
And just going back to what you said about your being a bit overawed with the standard of the beer that you were experiencing in that Tokyo homebrew club, I think having that sort of initial sense of dread, but then the sort of the commitment to succeed and hopefully exceed that level is what you will have needed to thrive, you know, running your own brewery. And I think this is the thing that I love so much about the independent craft beer scene, is that constant progression. And what was the best beer this time last year or 3 years ago wouldn't make anybody's top 10 today, because the fact is that everything is constantly moving forwards, and that you've got to have that drive to succeed and improve, haven't you?
Yeah, you know, there's just no more rules. There's there is a flight of fancy and whims that we all take now on a daily basis in our trade, where we're looking to just improve upon everything all the time. Mm-hmm. And we're open to experiment and change. I guess one way to think about this for me is I get a lot of applications from German brewers who've just finished their apprenticeship. And a lot of them, you know, when we're looking for new staff and that, they write, I'm looking to be in an environment where I don't have to pay attention to the German purity law. And it just shows that they're looking, they're forward thinking, they're open-minded, and they don't want to be stuck in this sort of environment or situation where they can't experiment and try new stuff. Nobody wants to be held to these sort of past notions of what it means to brew great beer. We have for about 8 or 9 months now been doing a lot of beers where we don't actually boil the wort. We bring it up to about 95 degrees and then we send it to the whirlpool. And that's thanks to a good friend of mine from Sweden. He was like, we're going to try this old Norwegian style where you don't boil it. And my German brewers were just freaking out. there's no way it's going it's not going to spoil and there won't be microorganisms and all this. And it turned out to just be one of the better beers we ever brewed. And it's just become a regular thing now that, you know, we sit there and have a conversation as I'm formulating a recipe. I look over to my lead production brewer and I say, so do we boil this one? And, you know, he we have to sit and literally talk it through to see whether or not it's going to fit the character of all the ingredients. And yeah, I think that's just a testament to the fact that everyone is inspiring each other to continue to push boundaries and do things that just would have been unheard of 30 years ago.
They literally are no rules. No, that's fabulous.
Yeah, yeah. There was this, thing, 1940s, 50s, whatever, when refrigeration really took hold, modern methods of keeping things fresh and cold, and industrial brewing took hold and kind of dumbed down brewing worldwide.
Yep.
It was a race to make the lightest, driest lagers that you could think of. They even called them in Japan the dry wars. So you had all of these lagers racing to be the most flavorless thing you can imagine. Now, I still love Asahi Super Dry. It's, it's probably more just because of the nostalgia and the memories I've created while having it with friends in Japan. But it really limited what people were doing. You saw all kinds of traditional breweries go out of business because they were just pushed out because there was a massive movement toward industrial light lager.
Yeah, it's tragic, isn't it?
It is. And American craft brewing, beginning, I think a lot of people would point to Fritz Maytag and Anchor Brewing Company as one of the catalysts of this. Mm-hmm. And then you can make a logical step right to Ken Grossman and Sierra Nevada. And you can see that it was a reaction. They couldn't find European beers in the States. And so they thought, we're going to brew them at home. And then they thought, oh, you know what? We're going to start companies and brew them. Ken Grossman started a homebrew shop first so that other people could get these ingredients and make an English pale ale. So, it was a very reactionary force against this dumbing down of what beer had become.
This week in Craft Beer, the podcast is sponsored by Beer Nuts. Beer Nuts is a British company inspired by the European fashion for pairing savoury snacks with different beer styles. Beer Nuts are premium crunchy coated peanuts and come in three great flavours, classic, masala curry and jalapeno. They are packaged in 100% recyclable, plastic-free single-serve cans and are vegan-friendly. Next day delivery is available from their webshop at beernuts.co.uk, spelled B-I-E-R. Beer Nuts are the ultimate beer pairing snack, perfect for pubs, tap rooms, bars, bottle shops, and more. For details of a special offer, please see page 7 of our weekly newsletter at thisweekincraft.beer. Okay, so I'm back with Tom from Mondo. So I guess I'd be curious to get a little bit of a commentary on 2020 from Mondo's perspective, Tom, and how you've reacted to the shifting sands that we're all dealing with, in particular what your plans are between now and the end of the year and beyond.
Right, yeah, sure. I think we were monitoring it, as everyone else was, perspective of watching the virus sort of take over China and then slowly move its way to every other part of the world. And prior to lockdown, we were probably about 50-50 split between keg and then can and bottle. But we are definitely heavy on restaurant pub trade as opposed to online small pack takeaway sales. And the tap room itself really only constituted less than 5% of our turnover.
Oh, wow.
So, again, we have some great relationships with restaurants and bars throughout the UK. And so it was a quite a adjustment we had to make. First of all, we had to figure out what to do with beer in keg. Some of it had to be destroyed. Some of it we were able to start pouring into 5-liter takeaway or local delivery.
Mini kegs, yeah.
Mini kegs, essentially, yeah. A very imperfect device is what that is. And we had to switch everything else that was in tank into can or bottle. And if you can imagine, everyone's doing that all at the same time. And that's going to cause a sort of bottleneck on the supply of cans, aluminum.
Definitely. and
glass. Glass, we haven't had a tough time sourcing. It's the aluminum,
Yep.
Everybody quickly switched to cans, and the companies had to start parsing out specific allotments to people based on what they had bought prior to COVID-19. So that limits what you can actually do. And we had all of these specialty and seasonal beers coming up. So trying to source more cans was a problem. But luckily, as we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, brewers are helping brewers. And right. I reached out to friends in the industry who are certainly economic competitors, and they gladly asked me information that turned out to be very useful. And we were able to find a way to continue that, putting our beer into can. For us right now, 440 mil cans are the vehicle of choice. They sell well. It makes for a good mixed case of beer. You can get six of four different styles, mm-hmm. and you get a nice, nearly a pint. I think that's around a U.S. pint anyway.
A decent measure anyway, that's for sure, yeah.
Yeah, for enjoying at home. And so that was the biggest adjustment. It was mm-hmm. moving from these outward sales that were being conducted by salespeople who were on the street, foot to pavement, going from pub to pub, shop to shop, and selling, to us essentially building an online shop, designing boxes. At first, for the 12 packs, we were just cutting down 24 pack boxes ourselves.
Oh, wow.
Marketing and events guy, sat there and painstakingly figured out exactly where you need to cut a box to make it work, and then showed the rest of us how to do it. And we just started, until we could get 12 pack boxes. So all of that was just a learning process. Luckily we were quick to the draw and got out, I think, somewhat ahead of it. We were building a new website at the time anyway. That's just gone live a few weeks ago.
Yep.
And now has the e-commerce shop sort of built into it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before you would click on a link on the old website and it would take you to a separate place.
Right. And so do you mind sharing what your current sort of production is compared to pre-lockdown, in terms of volume?
Sure. Yeah. So week one and two, we were a bit nervous. We didn't know what to do. So we just brewed once each uh-huh. week. And as the changes started occurring and we started to get our method of delivery out there to the consumer, and we saw sales sort of uptick, and these takeaway shops started to open again. Within probably a month, we moved up to about two brews. Prior to lockdown, we were doing six to eight brews, let's call it seven brews a week. And after lockdown, the first couple of weeks we did one brew a week, and then slowly moved to two. We're now up to five, so we're back near levels of pre-lockdown. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen Saturday. Looks to me like if I pay attention to what's happening in the States a lot, because I have friends and family living there.
Sure.
And I can only imagine something similar will happen if people aren't social distancing and wearing masks and taking care to be cautious when they're in large groups.
Yep.
We're not opening the tap room right away.
No.
We have enough sales between our online shop and our wholesale customers are coming back. We want to be there for them. So we are doing deliveries all this week to all of the pubs that are open. We don't have the space to really make it worthwhile to create a social distancing sort of environment within our tap room. So we may do takeaway pints, but at the moment we're not going to open the tap room for drinkers to come in and enjoy the beers.
No, and as you say, if it's 5 to 10% of your total anyway, it's important, because it's your sort of shop window, isn't it, in the showcase. It's not critical for your business. Where if you were if you're running a restaurant or a pub and you've had no revenue for the last 3 months, then it's a different sort of imperative, isn't it, to get something open this week. But
certainly, yeah. So we made that decision early on, as soon as we heard that the 4th was the date, and as much as we can, we'll just supply our mostly South London, Central London pubs and restaurants with the beers that they need.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes perfect sense. We should talk about the dipper before we a couple more areas I want to explore with you, Tom. But let's talk about this. This is delicious. This is Lilu.
Right. Yeah.
Your
so every
is that your sixth or your fifth birthday? Fifth birthday for brewing purposes,
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we considered June when we went really into trade, June of 2015 when the first beer sort of really hit the shelves.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We had supplied Deschume, which is a wonderful partner of ours from day one.
Yes.
We'd supplied them in late April, early May of 2015, and then really got the rest of the beers out to trade in June. And so every year we come up with this idea for a double IPA, which was one of my favorite styles.
Mm-hmm.
And each year we just like to play on, I don't know, something naming wise, something weird. The last couple of birthdays, it's been science fiction, which I'm a huge fan of.
Right.
It just made sense. Fifth birthday, Fifth Element. And Lilu was Mila Jovovich's character in the movie.
Yep.
Fifth birthday, five grains, five different hops. That was sort of the play there. We used spelt, oats, wheat, extra pale malt, and rye. And then this does have quite a bit of a bittering kick. We did use hops from the five main growing regions around the world. We used Centennial and East Kent Goldings in the Boyle, Hallertau, Mittelfroy, Amarillo, and Motueka in the Whirlpool, Centennial, Galaxy, Amarillo, and Motueka in the dry hop in grand proportion.
Nice.
And it has our signature house yeast, which is in all of our house IPAs. It's right. I really enjoy blending yeast, and I found a great strain. A friend of mine from Miami, Jonathan Wakefield.
Right.
He and I had been discussing doing a beer together, and we both agreed on mixing because he's American and we were getting it named. And we both agreed on mixing a U.S. and an English strain. And we've been really using that blend ever since as our house yeast.
I mean, your Wake and Bake collab with Jay Wakefield was sort of one of the more celebrated releases, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, over the past few years?
Indeed. It was a fun beer to make and a fun beer to drink. It was a bit of a blinder, as is with most of our high ABV beers. The boys in the brewery are always having these little competitions of who can drink the most. And that one was that one had some silly little videos, you know, that we share on our WhatsApp group that ended up, you know, making everyone laugh. We potentially have something else coming up with Jonathan this year. Again, COVID sort of stepped in the way of all that. But hopefully he has plans to come back.
Please tell me it's going to be an Imperial Stout.
That's exactly what it was going to be. We were thinking of calling it Wake and Cake.
I mean, if there's a brewery with a bigger reputation for Imperial Stouts than Jay Wakefield, I'm not sure that I've heard about it. That's for sure.
Absolutely. And he was big on, you know, bringing something he's sort of, you know, really in, knee deep in the pastry stout style.
Yeah.
And, we've dabbled with it. We've got a pastry stout collaboration we did with Heretic, currently aging in bourbon barrels, and we were going to do something along that vein, but maybe something that would be ready a lot faster.
Okay, nice. Is barrel aging a big part of your I mean, obviously it's not a big part of anybody's production, but it's an important part of your production, I guess, is it?
It is. I had only ever barrel aged beers at home, and took a lot of time to, I went to a barrel making school down in Bordeaux, France, and did a lot of research before purchasing any barrels. And the first ones that we ended up getting were some barrels for our first barrel aged incarnation of Figgy Smalls, which is a Belgian dark strong. And we only aged that one for about 6 months in Chardonnay barrels before racking it off into bottles. The stout, however, I worked with a brewer named Jamil Zainashev of Heretic Brewing Company. He and I came up with a plan to age this one for a year and a half. And he has a technique that he uses where he blends it back with a fresh batch. And so you over oak it to begin with, and then you dial that oak back and get more yield by blending with a fresh batch.
Okay.
So we're in the process of we're coming up on a year and a half. It'll be a year and a half this fall with that beer. So we'll brew the second wave of it, the fresh non-barrel aged version, in late August, and it'll be ready for release sometime in probably late October, early November.
And you package that in what, 750 bottles or?
We might go can. Okay. We've been discussing it around the brewery, and we thought it'd be a fun thing to try in 440 mil cans. You don't normally see a big pastry stout. We were going down the vein of we were trying to do something particularly English. So we came up with a bunch of ingredients from a banoffee pie.
Right.
And so that's sort of the theme going in this beer so far.
Okay. I had a barrel-aged imperial stout from a 440 can last weekend, actually, from Vocation. That was really good.
Very cool. All right. Yeah, yeah. Good to hear people doing it. Yeah.
I had banana in it as well, actually. It was a good beer.
Nice.
What are your plans for Mondo in 2021 and beyond?
Well, you know what? Our biggest foreign market was actually Italy for the longest time, but everything has sort of ceased. We're not exporting any beer at the moment. Right up until COVID-19, we were about to take over the building next to us. We had our sights on a couple of locations for tap rooms. Mm-hmm. We just have to, just like everyone else, it's really just a wait and see game. I don't know how else to explain it other than we have to be cash conscious, number one.
Yep.
And we very much just have to see how this thing plays out, particularly this weekend.
Yes.
And then moving forward, you know, we're constantly hearing about the race toward a vaccine. Mm-hmm. I hope it happens. I hope we can return to a degree of normalcy where we're all standing together in a pub again someday soon.
Sure.
But at the moment, our focus is just to make sure that, number one, we're providing for our employees.
Yep.
Number two, that we are staying safe in our work habits and our environment. And number three, that we are continuing to do something a bit innovative that our customers who are staying true to the brand. I mean, with our the online shop and the new website, we're able to see about who's a repeat customer and all that stuff. It's fantastic to see these people order week in and week out.
Yeah.
and really just become so brand loyal.
Yep.
It's heartwarming. We're trying to reach new customers. We do a lot of social media promotions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here now. I very much was looking forward to this conversation, but at the same time, I knew it's a chance for me to speak to maybe a crowd of people that have never heard of Mondo up to now,
right,
and want to support a small local business that is looking at the world the same way everyone else is, with a bit of alarm and a bit of trepidation and wondering what's going to happen next. So for us, all of that, any way to reach the market, reach our drinkers, reach our demographic and talk to them and tell them we're here, we're producing stuff every day. We're being as creative as we can possibly be. Check out the new website, look at the store, buy some beer. It just helps a small brand, a small craft company, carry on and continue to provide something different from, as we were saying before, something mass produced.
Yeah, no, I think that's brilliant, Tom. And I think, look, I was actually looking at your website this afternoon, and you guys, apart from your own beers on there, have got a terrific range of guest beers as well. So you're extremely well stocked there at the moment, and it's not hard to put a really interesting case together there. From my perspective, I think you guys, obviously, you've put a lot of effort into building the business to where it's at. I think you're in this period, it's been necessary for everybody to become much more hyper local in the way that they've been focused on their local markets. And so I think in your area, you already had that focus, didn't you? As you say, you were already in most of the local pubs as far as you could be, and a lot of restaurants as well. And so I think sort of breweries that have sort of opened in the last year or 18 months, where they've been able to just sell through distribution and send kegs out to tap rooms and not had to worry too much about building up the local market, those are the guys that have probably really struggled in this period. And I'm very sympathetic to those people, but I think potentially you know, we're gonna see, unfortunately, some of those not make it through to the other side.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Todd and I talked about from day one was the fact that we wanted to own Southwest London. Mm-hmm. That we chose that location for a reason. When we moved in, there wasn't a whole lot of foot traffic on Stewart's Road. The reconstruction on Battersea Power Station was just beginning. There were really no other breweries around us. Sandbrooks is a little further south. Belleville has since opened up. Of course, you've got Brixton just to the east of us. Yeah. Orbit as well is not too far away. But we wanted the majority of our sales to be in a neighborhood, and they still are. It's somewhere over 75%. Is within, you know, 4.5 miles of the radius of the brewery.
That's fantastic. So, that really is hyper local, yeah.
We had to win the hearts and minds of the neighborhood in order to make this thing a sustainable operation. Mm-hmm. If we were just sending beer off to Sweden or the United States or France or Italy, I wouldn't feel right about it, number one, because the whole point of a local craft brewery is that people in the neighborhood are getting or enjoying it and becoming sort of these brand loyal, almost proselytizers for the brand. You know,
right.
They're going out and doing more sales for the brand than we are.
Definitely. Yeah. And as you say now, you know, the beauty of sort of being driven into an e-commerce world is now you've got visibility of who those people are. You know, you maybe be able to recognize some of them by face, you know, coming in the tap room and even a bit further afield than that in your local area. But now, you know where these people live. You know,
that's, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
quite a lot to be said for that.
We were talking about those 5-liter mini kegs, and we did a collaboration with Three Chiefs from Los Angeles. We've actually done two with them now. And the second one was about to release right in the end of March, and we were forced to shelve it, and we ended up selling it in 5-liter mini kegs. And we had one fella come 3 times on a Saturday. There's 7 pints in that thing, and he had a little party at his house, and that's what they wanted to drink. They didn't go and get one mini keg of the Three Chiefs Mondo collaboration and drink it and then go on to something else. That was the only thing they wanted, so they kept coming back to get another one. And I, you know, the warmth in my heart and the glow on my face to see him again the third time, it was, I had to give him some free beer at that point. I was like, here, take a few cans with you as well, because I can't imagine a better ambassador for the brand than this guy.
No, absolutely. You know, and you can be sure that, you know, as soon as you're opened up again, he's going to be back, and, you know, and he's not going anywhere, is he? That's
he's great. Been back several times since. Yeah.
That's great to have those kind of local relationships. One thing I wanted to check in with you, we're coming up to sort of hop picking season, and you know, normally I'm sure you would be thinking about jumping on a plane to somewhere in the Pacific Northwest or whatever to go and you know, go and rub some hops and choose your hops for next year. So you know, how are you going to deal with that this time, and you know, what's your strategy?
Well, lucky for us, our key accounts manager Jack Langridge, he's from Kent, as he would say, Kent to the core. And his uncle runs a hop farm. And last year we took the whole team down, and we picked a bunch of hops for a fresh hop beer. It was a fantastic experience. We really had a great time. I mean, we got to ride on the tractor. We got to cut hops from the trellis.
Nice.
It was just one of the most amazing experiences. You know, that's the home of the Oast House.
Right.
You know, those old traditional hop drying, a very unique architecture buildings.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you still see quite a few of them in Kent, don't you, as you're driving across the county? Yeah,
absolutely. And it was. I can't describe. We went down the night before and we camped and we drank a bunch of beer, and then we got up in the morning early and we headed out to the hop farm and helped out as best we could. And I don't know that we can top that, and I don't know that it will happen this year. So we are in touch. So we've got a good relationship with a major supplier from the Pacific Northwest. And they have been very good to us over this last few months, giving us access to some experimental hops. And I would very much love to see what's on deck for this year and be able to pick out my own lots of Citra and Amarillo and Simcoe and Centennial and all the hops that we regularly use in our core beers. I just don't see it happening. I you know, the West Coast of the United States right now is blowing up with, you know, somewhere around 10,000 new cases a day. And I just can't imagine going into an environment like that for the simple fact of smelling hops. We're trying to do our best to be conscious about what's happening in the world and not try to participate in any kind of event that's going to make anyone's life more stressful.
No, absolutely. But I guess you have the sort of the contract history with those suppliers to be able to secure the supply you need. Obviously, it's not ideal that you can't go and actually choose the batches, but you've probably got a trusted relationship where you know you're going to get decent quality, don't you? Absolutely.
Yeah. And not just that, they've been really good about coming up with really detailed analysis. They typically use a gas chromatograph and are able to give us levels of different components of a hop that let us understand what kind of flavor, aroma, the entire bittering profile of a hop, and help us choose some of these new experimentals to play with. And, you know, by and large, the more traditional West Coast IPA and newer New World hops, we trust them to give us a fresh batch. We trust them to take it and cold store it correctly in a CO2 positive environment until it gets to us. And we've had a lot of luck with really fresh ingredients from them. So I just have to leave it in their professional hands for the time being and trust they're going to do their job.
No, absolutely. You know, you're not going to get the pleasure of the selection, but it doesn't sound as though it's going to make a massive negative impact to production.
Very good.
So I have a wrap-up question for you, but before I get to that, I'm just curious to know if there's anything else you wanted to use this platform to raise, Tom. I mean, you know,
we have been involved this summer with a couple of worthy causes. We worked with Other Half to create the All Together beer, and that was our chance to contribute something to pub restaurant workers. We're currently brewing a beer for Black is Beautiful, and you know, Black Lives Matter to us every day. And going through this as an American living here and seeing what is happening in my own country, we stand in solidarity with underrepresented groups in this industry. And we want to make sure that participating in this beer, we're just trying to keep our minds and hearts open to everything that can possibly be in brewing. You know, when I go to brewing events, it's overwhelmingly a single demographic. And we would just like to see more people represented because it's such a great product that brings people together. So why not bring a more diverse crowd together? And we're brewing. I actually have to go back to the brewery tonight. So we're brewing Black is Beautiful today, and it is such a big beer. We've been loudering it for the last 12 hours. And so I have to go back and see the brew through for the night because two different shift brewers, a morning brewer and an evening brewer, have exhausted their eight-hour shifts, and I've got to go and relieve them.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's a very, very worthy worthy use of your time. Anyway, no, we've actually been promoting Black is Beautiful in the newsletter the past few weeks. And so I was very happy to see you guys sign up there. I know the website's a bit slow to update. I sort of check it a couple of times a week, and I'm always frustrated that there's not more UK brewers on the list. I don't know whether there's more signed up that aren't actually published on the website yet, but I'm hoping that one or two more do join that because, you know, as you say, it's just such a worthy cause. You know, it also helps that that there's a, you know, there's a big appetite for imperial stouts out there right now, so I'm hoping that the beers that come out of that are going to be some really interesting beers to drink as well. So I think it's very, very worthwhile, and I'd love to think that there's going to be a few, you know, maybe even just one brewer that hears this podcast and pitches into that that collaboration. I know that it's going to run right at least through to the end of the year, isn't it? I heard a short interview with the owner of the called Weathered Souls, aren't they, I think, in San Antonio.
Yeah, those are the fellas.
And yeah, the guy was saying that, you know, basically they're going to keep it open at least until the end of the calendar year. So there's plenty of time for people to sign up and get on board with that that fantastic global collaboration.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, Tom, I do have a wrap-up question for you. I think I previewed it to you, but it's what would be your ultimate happy hour? I'm curious to know where that would be, who you would be with, and what you'd be drinking.
I think my ultimate happy hour is I looked at that question when you sent the sent the email over, and I was thinking of all these sort of tropical locations that I've been throughout my life, and actually it's right back there in the brewery. It's in the tap room, you know, and it would be with all of the members of Mondo Brewing Company, past and present, having a beer with them and saying thank you for all their hard work, because without them, Mondo Brewing Company has been nothing. The brewers, bartenders, accountant, salespeople, I'm nothing without them. Mm-hmm. They are the heart and soul of the company, and it's their hard work and dedication that has brought us this far. There's no greater people I can think of to enjoy a beer with after work at happy hour than the people that have made Mondo Brewing Company what it is today.
That's a great answer, but you didn't tell me which beer you're going to be drinking, Tom. I need to know that as well.
Nice. Yeah. For that, I would probably choose. We made one called. Now I'm going to butcher this because it's a northern phrase. I up.
Okay. Yeah. I up. A general
exactly.
Positive.
I think Tom is originally from Blackpool, and he says it all the time. And when we were at the London Craft Beer Festival last year, we had a bunch of Northerners come and try to correct him on the spelling and the pronunciation. And he's like, wait a second, we say it where I'm from. I know how to spell it. So, I love that beer. It was a great beer.
What kind of beer was it? I'm not familiar with it.
That was part of our House IPA series.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was just another really, you know, low bittering, very juicy, fruity. I got to tell you, I was 5 years ago, I was really against hazy IPAs because I found it an imperfection. You know, I thought, wait a second, we can do better than that. But I went to enough beer festivals and hung out with some people who are very well known for making those styles of beers. And I just grew to love them. And it just happens to be one of my favorite styles to drink now. And was one of those the beers that really helped me change my mind about how to brew it and what it should taste like, and it was a great beer.
Fantastic. All right, well, that's a good answer, Tom. Really grateful to you for your time. Thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I love you guys down in Battersea there. I'm looking forward to the chance to get back to the tap room at some point, but I totally understand it shouldn't be this week. I think, you know, let's wait until it's safe to do so, but in the meantime, wish you every luck. And, you know, looking forward to seeing you guys thrive and prosper over the next couple of years.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks very much. Have a good evening. And I hope the Black is Beautiful turns out as to be everything you're expecting.
I hope so, yeah.
Thanks very much. Cheers, Tom.
Cheers.
Bye. Bye. Hi, all. It's Rob with a brief footnote to the episode. The Black is Beautiful global collaboration that Tom and I discussed was launched by Weathered Souls Brewing in San Antonio, Texas. Black is Beautiful is a collaborative effort to raise awareness for the injustices people of colour face daily and raise funds for police brutality reform and legal defences for those who have been wronged. If you are interested in participating, please visit blackisbeautiful.beer. The website currently lists 946 breweries from 18 countries, including Mondo, Cloudwater, Brewdog, Unity, Forest Road and Crafty Devil from the UK. The initiative is going to run at least through until the end of 2020, so we hope that a few more UK independent craft breweries join in.